Good morning. So we're going to continue with a little bit of special relativity, and then I hope begin some general relativity. So last time I gave you an argument why E equals mc squared. I'm now going to give you a second argument, and in a little bit a third argument. The third one, I believe, is the real conclusive one. But the second argument is as follows. It's a formal argument. It's more like an argument, wouldn't it be nice if E was mc squared? And the argument is it's natural to unify energy and momentum into a four vector. Right? That's the basic principle of special relativity. Whatever we have, we try and cram it into things with four space-time indices. And it works. Okay, so energy and momentum are obvious candidates. And so let's define a four momentum. And of course, we've got to divide the energy by c in order to get the units right. So energy is m half mv squared. But we could put the spatial momentum in the other components. So in general, in this first part of the course, I try to keep all the units correct. And so if something is called a four momentum, it should have units of momentum. And if something is a four velocity, it should have units of velocity, and so on. Later on, we'll set c equal to 1. But it's good to start out being correct anyway. So now let's consider a particle moving in space-time. And so following Minkowski, we're going to draw space-time. And what is a particle? Well, a particle is obviously a particle follows a world line in space-time. And this world line is some curve, x mu of lambda, where lambda is a parameter running along the curve. So this is called a world line of the particle. And we say that the world line is time-like if eta mu nu dx mu d lambda dx nu d lambda is less than 0. Remember, eta has a minus sign in the time-time component. So if this quantity is negative, we say the vector, the four vector along the world line, dx mu d lambda, is time-like. We say it is null if this quantity equals 0, and we say it is space-like if this quantity is greater than 0. Now, of course, what this condition means is the particle is moving slower than the speed of light, because if you write this out, you'll get minus c squared dt squared plus dx squared over d lambda squared. Okay, so when dx dt is less than c, when dx dt is less than c, then the world line is time-like. And we refer to such particles whose world line is always time-like as massive particles. We'll see why in a moment. And if their world line is null, we call them massless particles. And if there were particles with space-like world lines, we would call these tachyons. And such particles don't exist. They would be extremely useful if they did exist, because then you could travel faster than the speed of light. But they don't seem to, and in fact, if they did exist, they would cause all kinds of logical problems. So for massive particles, let's start with those. We can define a proper time along the world line. And this is defined by d tau squared equals dt squared minus dx squared over c squared. And so d tau is equal to dt square root 1 minus dx dt squared over c squared. And this is possible because the right-hand side is positive. And so that, of course, is equal to the velocity of the particle by definition. The velocity of the particle is dx dt. And so this is dt times root 1 minus v squared over c squared. It's obvious from here that the proper time is Lorentz invariant. If I do a Lorentz transformation on t and x, that quantity is invariant just because this is equal to eta mu nu dx mu dx nu over c squared. And the right-hand side is obviously Lorentz invariant. So everybody's going to agree, all observers are going to agree on what the proper time is along the particle. So now we can define the full velocity. And if you ask physically, what is the proper time? Well, the proper time is the time as measured in a Lorentz frame where dx is 0, where the particle isn't moving. So if I choose a Lorentz frame which is traveling with the particle, then in that frame, the particle world line doesn't move. So dx is 0, so d tau is dt. So the tau is the time measured by a clock which the particle carries with it. Now the four velocity is a four vector constructed from x mu of lambda. And and this is obviously a four vector because x transforms with Lorentz transformation. Tau does not transform. And so this is a four vector. By definition, so this is equal to u mu is equal to that. And it follows that eta mu nu, u mu u nu, is minus 1. OK, just follows from the, in fact, there's a minus sign up here. From this equation, minus eta mu nu dx mu detour dx nu detour. In fact, I need a C somewhere. Yeah, that's correct, over C squared. As I said, anything called a velocity has dimensions of velocity. So u mu has dimensions of velocity. and it automatically satisfies that equation. So the 4 velocity squared is minus 1 for a massive particle. The 4 momentum, and this is where we come back to energy and momentum, p mu is m naught u mu, and m naught is the called the rest mass. This is a number on which everyone will agree. It's a quantity which doesn't change under Lorentz transformations, and it's equal to the mass as measured in the rest frame of the particle. And so it follows from this that eta mu nu p mu is minus m naught squared c squared. And of course, this is equal to minus p naught squared plus p squared. So we can, if we identify, p naught with E over C, then E is equal to square root of p squared c squared plus m naught squared c to the fourth. And then if we assume that this term is much smaller, that this first term is much smaller than the second term, we can expand the square root. So this is if magnitude of p is much less than m naught c. So it's plausible because p, at least at small velocities, p will be just m times v. And if v, velocity of the particle, is much less than the speed of light, we expect this first term to be smaller than the second term. And then we can expand the square root, pull out this factor of m naught c, pull this factor outside the square root, and expand the square root, and we get plus 1/2 m naught p over m naught squared plus higher order. And we recognize this term as the familiar Newtonian kinetic energy, Ke, because P is mv, so that's just a half mv squared. And we have this extra term. Which says that the energy, even if a particle is at rest, the energy is mc squared. So even though this isn't a rigorous argument in any way, I suspect this is the argument that led Einstein to E equals mc squared. It just everything works so naturally if we say that particles have a rest mass energy. So we call this the rest mass energy. And in general, of course, I'm sure you've done this before, at any v, we can say v is dx dt, and this turns out to be p over p naught over c, which is c p over square root p squared plus m naught squared c squared. OK, Okay, so that's the general formula for the velocity of a massive particle as a function of its momentum. And obviously you see that if you apply a force to the particle and you make its momentum rise to infinity, as the momentum goes to infinity, the particle just approaches the speed of light. So this is immediately telling you, providing you believe that what forces do is to change momentum. This is telling you that, so if you apply a force to increase the magnitude of P, then as P goes to infinity, the velocity of the particle goes to C. So this is immediately telling you that there's a limit to how fast you can make a particle travel by giving it momentum. And we'll see in a moment that's exactly what forces do. They act directly on P. And similarly, you can show that gamma, which is square root 1 minus V squared over C squared, is just given by this same square root, m naught squared c squared over m naught c. And obviously, as you send the momentum to infinity, the gamma factor can go to infinity, but the velocity can never get bigger than c. And it follows that the energy is gamma m naught c squared. So that's the total energy of the particle for any velocity, v, where gamma is this factor. And this is the rest mass energy, m naught c squared. OK, so that was a second suggestion, that E equals m naught c squared. But now we're, we're going to give the most profound argument in favor of it. And that comes from the Noether theorem, which explains what energy is. Okay, so what M.E. Noether discovered is that is the following statement, that for every continuous symmetry of the action, there is a corresponding conserved quantity. Okay, so I haven't talked about actions much, just in passing. But the one thing we've learned about fundamental physics is that all of the laws of fundamental physics can, for some mysterious reason, be formulated as an action principle. At least all the ones we know, all the ones we've verified. Whether it's electromagnetism or general relativity or the motion of particles or the Dirac equation or the standard model of particle physics, we can write down a formula, which is the action. So these nature employs, or nature is extremely well described by variational principles. And we even know how those variational principles enter into quantum theory. They come in the action is central in the path integral formulation of fundamental physics. So this action, S, is a very fundamental object. And I guess physicists told Noether, we're interested in actions and variational principles. And think about those. And so Noether realized that the important symmetries, or somebody told her, I don't know, the important symmetries in physics are all symmetries of the action. And she realized that every time you have a continuous symmetry, you inevitably get a conserved quantity. And it's kind of amazing this wasn't realized before, but as you see, as you'll see, it's quite a clever argument. Even though it's an elementary argument, it's quite clever. And of course, she took it a million miles forward from what I'm going to show you. She proved that she proved the implications of this theorem for general relativity and essentially sorted out the questions of what energy means or how to interpret conservation of energy in general relativity, which Hilbert and Einstein were stuck on. And so it was no mean problem. And she sorted it out and then moved on to more interesting things. She's an amazingly interesting person. And I encourage you to watch the lectures about Noether, because this, which were at Convergence, there was a special evening session devoted to Noether. And this year is the centenary of her discovery of the theorem, even though she didn't actually publish it for a couple of years. So she discovered the theorem, it's believed, in 1915, after conversations with Hilbert and others, then published it. And she had a very, very difficult and interesting life story. She was basically a radical, not surprising, given her own treatment. She was Jewish, she was a woman, she wasn't allowed to have a professorial position. She wasn't paid for a long time, even though they did allow her to teach. And then finally, being a Jew, she actually had to escape from the Nazis and came to the US and unfortunately died in her 50s. So very interesting person. Now, so I've talked about the action. Continuous symmetry, a continuous symmetry has an infinitesimal version. Okay, so by definition, a continuous symmetry is something where you can perform symmetry transformations of arbitrary size, and infinitesimal. And so let's just perform, all we need for Noether's theorem is the infinitesimal version of the symmetry. So the action, by definition, is a function of the coordinates and the velocities and potentially the time. It may even involve higher derivatives, but we won't be interested in those. There's this action, which is of course the integral of the Lagrangian. The infinitesimal version of the symmetry is just that QA prime of t. So the action, maybe I should write it down. The action, we can write it in square brackets. It's really a functional of integral dt. There's some initial time, some final time, and then there's a Lagrangian, which is an ordinary function of QA of t, QA dot of t, and potentially of t, the time. Okay, so the A's label the coordinates. In quantum field theory, there would be infinitely many of these coordinates, one for every spatial point. But in mechanics, there's just some finite number of Qs. And QA of t is the path of the system, the path followed by the system in time. And the statement is that physical systems follow paths which extremize the action. That gives you the Lagrangian equations of motion. So the infinitesimal version of a symmetry is to take a path and just change it by a small amount. Okay, so instead of following some QA of t, we're going to change the path by a small amount. This is QA prime of t. And so QA prime of t is equal to QA of t plus epsilon times XA of Q, let's call it QB, QB dot, and T. And this quantity here is called the generator of the symmetry. And this quantity is called the parameter of the symmetry. Okay, so epsilon is just a number, which could be anything, and it tells you how big a symmetry transformation you performed. The XA is just some function of the coordinates and the velocities, and every symmetry operation corresponds to some particular choice for this X. The statement is, this is a symmetry, if the action of evaluated on this new trajectory, QA prime of t, the action, as I've said, is really a functional, QA dot of t is equal to the original action, QA of t, QA dot of t, up to surface terms. Okay, so surface terms are allowed in this definition of symmetry. And if your action is invariant under the infinitesimal version of the continuous symmetry up to surface terms, you say that's the symmetry of the action. So the proof is as follows. The point is that epsilon is a constant here, independent of time. And the statement is that the action, the change in the action is zero up to surface terms, as long as epsilon is a constant. Okay. So let's just spell that out. In the definition of symmetry, epsilon is assumed to be constant. So consider, this is the clever part of the argument, consider making epsilon a function of time. Epsilon of t. Then the variation, this one up here, let's call that one, is a perfectly allowed variation. Hence, we must have that the variation of the action is zero to order epsilon using the equations of motion. Okay, so what Noether is arguing is that even if I made epsilon a function of t, the variation of the action still has to be zero, but only after you use the equations of motion. However, before using the equations of motion, the local coefficient of, and by local I mean in time, the local coefficient of epsilon of t will take the form of a conservation law. Okay, so let's to see this. To see this, all we have to do is write down the most general possibility for the result. The only possibility only possibilities for the variation are, well, the variation's got to be linear in epsilon, because we're only working to order epsilon. And so what could you possibly get? Well, one thing you might get is epsilon dot, because you see, by definition, the action was invariant if epsilon was a constant. But this term would certainly be invariant if epsilon was a constant, qq dot t. And the other possibility you might get is something which reduces to a surface term if epsilon is a constant. Okay, that's really all you can possibly get. It's obvious that when you vary an action, if it's only a function of first derivatives, and I plug in that formula for q and make epsilon a function of t, the most I'm going to get is one derivative of epsilon. And it must be that, such terms would be zero if epsilon was a constant. So they're fine. And then I could equally well get something which reduced to a surface term. So this term would be zero if epsilon equals constant. And this term would be a surface term if epsilon equals constant. So that's the only thing you can possibly get. Now, given that, we can integrate by parts, and we get integral dt epsilon of dk dt minus d, sorry, of d of d by dt of k minus j plus surface terms. And because the action, the variation of the action is always zero using the equations of motion, it must be, for arbitrary epsilon, it must be that this coefficient is zero using the equations of motion. So therefore, this is true for all epsilon of t. Therefore, d by dt of k minus j equals zero using the equations of motion. So that's it. Very simple theorem with extremely profound consequences. So let's work out the consequences. Just some consequences, there are many. Imagine, for example, so if the action is translation invariant, and that means that I QA prime is QA plus epsilon A. So just take all the coordinates and shift them by some parameters. So here I'm actually putting in one parameter for every coordinate. And so the laws of classical mechanics, for example, Newtonian mechanics, are typically invariant under translations. And more generally, laws of quantum field theory, translation invariance is usually built into the action. Then of course, what we do to apply Noether's argument, we okay for epsilon A constant. Then we make, so Noether says, let QA prime equals QA plus epsilon A of T. And now we vary the action. The action, as I remind you, is an integral dt of the Lagrangian of QA, QA dot, and T. And so the variation of the action is equal to the integral. So first of all, I've got to vary with respect to QA. So I just use the chain rule, differentiate the Lagrangian with respect to QA, and multiply by epsilon A. And then I differentiate with respect to Q dot A. And you see this equation implies that QA dot prime, the change in the velocity, is QA dot plus epsilon A dot. So the change in the velocity is just epsilon A dot. And this must be zero for all epsilon A of T, using the equations of motion. Now, this one is zero by the assumption of symmetry, by assumption of translation invariance, And so in this case, I just integrate by parts, and I see that d by dt of dl dqa dot equals zero. And of course, this is the momentum. This is the definition of the momentum PA. So momentum is conserved by the equations of motion for any translation invariant action. So momentum is conserved as a consequence of translation invariance. Okay, so that's the simplest case. Why is that not working? More interesting case is energy. So this is translations of the coordinates Q, which in classical mechanics would be the spatial coordinates of your system. What about time translation? Invariance. Okay, so what this says is that if I take QA of t and I replace it with QA prime of t, which is QA of t plus epsilon. Right, so just take your original trajectory and translate it in time by epsilon. Okay, that's the time translation. If the action is invariant, then this won't change it. And for the actions we typically write down, which involve velocities, they're not the velocity would not be. So most of the actions we write down would just involve things like dQ dt squared, which is obviously invariant under shifting t. So most of the actions we write down are, if they don't have explicit time dependence, are manifestly time translation invariant. So this is a very reasonable symmetry. And that, of course, if epsilon is small, is QA of t plus epsilon QA dot of t. So in this case, the generator XA is just QA dot. And similarly, the change in the velocity would be similarly QA dot of t would primed would be QA dot of t plus epsilon QA dot dot. Okay, if epsilon is a function of t. Okay, so now the variation of the action. Again, we compute it for arbitrary epsilon of t, and we get dL dQA, and then epsilon QA dot, just as before, because that's the variation in QA. And we get the next term is dL dQA dot. We have to vary QA dot, and we get epsilon QA dot dot. And then I integrate by parts. So up to surface terms, this is equal to integral epsilon. The first term is dL dQA QA dot. The second term I get a minus sign, minus d by dt, dL dQA dot. All multiplied by QA dot. Now, this looks awkward, but notice the following, that d by dt, remember, all of this is not using the equations of motion. I'm not allowed to use equations of motion. I'm just working out the coefficient of epsilon without using the equations of motion. So d by dt of L minus d by dt of dL dQA dot times QA dot. So just consider that quantity. What is d by dt of L? Oh, I should have said earlier on, we've assume there is no explicit time dependence in L. So L, i.e., L, the Lagrangian, is a function only of the QA and the QA dot. Okay, in that case, it would be, it looks time translation invariant. If you put explicit time dependence in the Lagrangian, obviously that would change, and this formula wouldn't be true. The variation in the action would be, have some variation due to varying the explicit time dependence too. So I've assumed there's no explicit time dependence. So what is d by dt of L? Well, L depends only on Q and Q dot. So this is equal to dL dQ QA dot plus dL dQA dot times QA double dot. That's from the first term. And then from the second term, we get minus d by dt dL dQ A dot times QA dot minus dL dQ A dot QA double dot. Okay, so the clever part of the argument is that the QA double dot terms cancel. And what I'm left with is exactly what I have here in the integral. Okay, so actually, we see that delta S is equal to integral epsilon d by dt of L minus d by dt dL dQA dot. Sorry, it's just dL dQA dot times QA dot. Now, we know that dL dQA dot is the momentum. And so this is integral epsilon d by dt of L minus PA QA dot. And this, you will recognize, is the Hamiltonian, or minus the Hamiltonian. OK, so what that proves is that H is conserved. Since this has to be 0 for arbitrary epsilon, it follows the coefficient must be 0. And so the Hamiltonian, or energy, is conserved as time evolves. So the conclusion of this is the reason why there is something called energy is because the world has no explicit time dependence. Okay, if you write down any mechanical system or quantum field theory with no explicit time dependence, such that the Lagrangian depends only on the fields and its time derivatives, you inevitably get a conserved energy. So this finally explained what energy and momentum are. They are Noether charges corresponding to symmetries of the laws of the action and the laws of physics. Now, in the real world, the world is changing with time. The universe is expanding, for example, and therefore Noether's theorem fails. Okay, therefore, there is no conserved energy in an expanding universe. There's something which is kind of like it, but it's not. It's not really conserved in the same sense. And so what we realize is that notions of energy and momentum conservation are actually only approximate. And they only hold to the extent that the universe is static. So let's now do this for relativity. Are there any questions about this, by the way? Yeah?
If you integrate between finite intervals, let's say finite time intervals, t1 to t2, then
you
impose
that
the surface terms vanish.
No, I don't impose anything. The argument says that this variation must vanish for arbitrary function epsilon of t. It doesn't matter what the surface terms are. I can pick an epsilon which vanishes on the boundary. So then these surface terms are zero. I can pick an epsilon, which is a delta function at any point in the time interval of the integral. And if I pick it to be a delta function, it just tells me this quantity must be zero at that particular moment of time inside the integral. So the fact that this is true for all epsilon leads to this conclusion, that every moment of time, the integrand must be zero. The coefficient of epsilon must be zero, because epsilon is arbitrary. So it doesn't matter if you get surface terms. You can just ignore them, because epsilon is arbitrary. Oh, sorry, you're right. Thank you. Thank you. It should not be there. Okay, so what I've proven here is that this integrand is actually equal to this whole expression. Now, it's actually interesting to look at Noether's theorem in textbooks. I encourage you to do that. And it's quite a mess. I should go offline, really. But have a look in Tony Z's book, which is really a wonderful textbook. But on this, it's a disaster. Okay. So, and Steven Weinberg, of course, his book on quantum field theory has a long chapter on Noether's theorem. It's all correct. It's very good. But it does everything in a very strange way. He doesn't do energy. He first does global symmetries, and then he keeps postponing energy, and it all gets rather complicated and messy. But this way of implementing Noether's theorem, where you simply make the parameters functions of time, or in general, you can make them functions of space and time if you're doing a field theory, that's actually the one which works in all cases. It's totally general. There's no example of Noether's theorem that doesn't amount to this. Okay. Now, let us apply this for relativity, and we're going to find something interesting, okay, in relativity, which you may have noticed a little bit of a problem with the action for a particle in relativity, that it's proportional to the mass. And it's a bit strange, but you'll find it in all the textbooks, that the action is proportional to the mass. And then you say, oh, well, I want to describe a massless particle. Well, the action is zero. It's not very useful. So they always go through a sort of convoluted argument to try to get around this point. But I'll explain to you at least my point of view, which I think is correct. Which is what you see. So there's a little bit of a subtlety to do with the action for a massless particle, which is that the way people conventionally present the action is that it's zero and doesn't depend on anything. Doesn't depend on the path or anything, right? It's just zero. So I'll get to this point. Okay, let's do relativity. And after all, we wanted to derive E equals mc squared from this. And we'll get there. So let's start off. Let's start with a massive particle. And it's following its world line. Okay. And so we want to know, what is the action for which describes the evolution of the, or which describes this particle world line. This particle world line should extremize something. And what is the something? Well, the something better be Lorentz invariant. And there's only one quantity which you could write down, one natural quantity, and that is this proper time. And so the action is a constant times the proper, let's call it the invariant by invariant, I mean Lorentz invariant, invariant length of the world line. Okay, that's really the only natural thing you could write down. Particle follows a line, and I minimize the length of the line. It's the only thing I can do. So this is a constant times integral square root minus e to mu nu dx mu dx nu. You could put in the parameter, if you like, the world line parameter. So you could have x mu as a function of lambda. And then you notice, and then now this is an integral over lambda, but you notice this is reparameterization invariant. If I change lambda to any other function of lambda, the d lambda here and the square root of the 1 over d lambda squared inside the root, these cancel. So this action is reparameterization invariant. Invariant. Okay, in other words, lambda can be changed to lambda twiddle, which is any function of lambda, and the action will not change. And the reason is the action doesn't even depend on lambda. I could just cancel the d lambdas. And so this is a constant times integral square root of t dot squared minus x dot squared d tau. Tau is one particular choice of t dot is dt d tau. It's also equal to integral. You see, I can pick. I can pick. Pick t as the parameter. Because I can parameterize the line just with the vertical axis, ct. I can just tell you where I am in space for every particular time. T as the parameter. Okay, in which case it's just constant times the integral of square root 1 minus x dot squared dt. And here, x dot is dx dt. Okay, so just put an or there. And the final form is kind of nice because it doesn't introduce any arbitrary parameterization. You can see from this that the constant has to have dimensions of inverse time. Because the action should have dimensions of h bar, but if we pretend h bar is 1, let's just say it this way. The constant has to have the right dimensions. Dimensions. I'll figure out the dimensions in a moment. I have unfortunately set c equal to 1. Let's not do that yet. And let's not do that, thank you. And we'll figure out the dimensions in a moment. So obviously following Noether, we would like to calculate the momentum of the particle. So the momentum is going to be dl dx dot. And that, just differentiating over there, is minus constant. The Lagrangian is that square root. So differentiating with respect to x dot, I get x dot over c squared over root 1 minus x dot squared over c squared. And so this is obviously telling me this is gamma. This is gamma x dot is v, times m naught. Okay, if I identify this with the quantity I previously saw was the momentum for the relativistic particle, that immediately tells me that the constant is minus m naught c squared. Okay, so we know that the action is equal to minus m naught c squared integral dt square root 1 minus x dot squared over c squared. And that makes sense because we know the dimensions of an action. It's an integral of half mv squared times dt. So if we, here's our mv squared, and that's the t. So this has the correct dimensions for an action. So now we can calculate the energy. And to calculate the energy, the energy is just the Hamiltonian. So it's dl dx dot, the momentum, times x dot minus the Lagrangian. And so this is, of course, minus m naught c squared times dl dx dot was x dot over root 1 minus x dot squared over c squared minus square root 1 minus x dot squared over c squared. And now, sorry, that was dl dx dot. It gets multiplied by x dot. And so now you notice if I combine terms in the numerator, I've got x dot squared. Sorry, I must have a minus sign somewhere wrong. Yes, when I differentiate this, I get another minus sign. And so in the numerator, I'll have minus x dot squared plus x dot squared. This minus 1 cancels that. And so I get m naught c squared over square root 1 minus x dot squared over c squared, which is gamma m naught c squared. Okay, so Noether's theorem tells you the energy is exactly the expression you would have guessed from the previous argument. Now, the beauty of Noether's theorem, and the reason this derivation is correct, is it applies no matter what the interactions are. I can couple my particle to electromagnetism, to any other force, to any other particles, and this definition of energy is the correct definition for the whole shebang. Okay, therefore, now only the whole energy will be conserved, because the whole action is invariant under time translations. So the energy of the individual particle won't even be conserved if it's interacting with other things. So the whole energy will be conserved. But this is the quantity I would call the energy contributed to by the particle. This is the part of the energy associated with the particle when you do Noether's variation. Okay, so it's this is really the correct definition of the energy. And it comes straight out of the action. So let me just point that out. Of course, the energy and momentum will not be conserved in the presence of interactions. Presence and energy momentum of the particle will not be conserved if the particle interacts with other things, e.g. fields, but Noether's definition of the energy definition will give you the contribution of the particle to the total energy and momentum of the combined system. Will be conserved. And none of the other arguments have that feature. Okay, so let us now couple the particle to some other things, and in particular to electromagnetism. Have I done this again? I've written on the back. Oh, that's fine. If I'm clever, I can, just cover it. Somehow this is working today. So we want to consider this particle interacting with some other things. Let's couple the particle to electromagnetism. And gravity. And you'll see how easy this is to do within the action formalism. So the action is going to be minus m naught c squared integral dt. Let's just write it this way. Square root minus eta mu nu. Ooh, I promised I would tell you what was funny about the massless particle. Actually, let me mention that briefly. From this point of view. I forgot to tell you that. Forgot to tell you the punchline. The funny thing is, you see, if I take this action, integral root 1 minus x dot squared, I guess c squared, over c squared dt, and I say I want to describe a massless particle. Okay? Well, I said m equals 0, the mass is action zero, so it's just useless. It doesn't tell me anything. However, if I do the following, good.
But isn't this, if you start from that point of view, I think you cannot even do that when you define the momentum there, because you're basically divided by zero for a massless particle, right? On shell, you have zero interval. So this whole argument of proportionality is only valid.
No, that's right. So what I'm saying is, let us do the derivation at finite m. And then try to take the limit and see if it makes sense.
Yeah. Okay.
The problem is the starting point doesn't make any sense. You can't expect anything else to make any sense if this made no sense. Okay. However, if you now go and work out, so keep finite M and go from the Lagrangian formalism to the Hamiltonian formalism. See, we've worked out the Hamiltonian. I've already told you what the Hamiltonian is. The Hamiltonian was the, did I work it out? I didn't work it out. Maybe I did. I said it was gamma M naught C squared, right? So if you work out the Hamiltonian from this, you actually get, try to get the factors right, square root of P squared plus C squared plus m squared c to the fourth. Okay, so if you go from the Lagrangian formalism to the Hamiltonian, this is what it is for a relativistic particle, right, with finite mass. Now you notice something rather nice. So take the massless limit, this is absolutely fine. There's nothing wrong with the Hamiltonian for a massless relativistic particle. Right, so I can take m go to 0, and h is just the magnitude of p times c. That's the Hamiltonian. Now you say, what is the equation of motion of a particle? Well, that I get from Hamilton's equations. Right? X dot is dh dp, which is the vector p over magnitude p times c. That's telling the particle moves at the speed of light with unit velocity. There's no problem at all with the Hamiltonian formalism. And obviously you get p dot is minus dh dx, which is 0 because the Hamiltonian is independent of x. So the momentum is conserved and the velocity is 1. So it's a kind of curiosity that the massless particle, it's actually a wonderful example because see, if you ask why does, you see, this is a bit of a strange Hamiltonian. Hamiltonian linear in the momentum, in which the equations of motion do not actually depend on the magnitude of the momentum, which they shouldn't. A photon moves at the speed of light, no matter what its momentum. And all of this is a consequence of conformal symmetry. Okay, the scale symmetry, you can show that scale symmetry leads to a Hamiltonian, which is linear in the momentum, not quadratic. And in this situation, the Lagrangian actually doesn't work. The Lagrangian is singular. You should drop the Lagrangian formalism. The Hamiltonian formalism is absolutely fine. Yep.
So what happened if you apply a Legendre transformation on that H?
You find you cannot solve for the momentum in terms of velocities. You know, when you apply Legendre transformation from L to H, you have to be able to solve for the velocities in terms of the momentum in order to eliminate the velocities in favor of the momentum.
Because the velocities are
independent. We can try and do it. So you would
What's
try.
What's all C, right? So.
Pardon?
The velocities always see it.
Well, it's in, yeah, so how am I going to, exactly, yeah. How am I going to recover p in terms of x dot? Okay. I can't solve this equation.
Yeah.
If the Hamiltonian was quadratic, then, of course, p is related to v. So then I can solve for p in terms of v. But in this situation, I cannot solve for p in terms of v. That tells me I can't construct the Hamiltonian, the Lagrangian from the Hamiltonian. It's just a singular example.
Okay, so is the fact that you can't have a photon arbitrary momentum is the reason, okay.
Yeah. So it's a very, very fundamental fact. And I'm sure Dirac knew all about this. If you read Dirac's book on, what is it called? Lectures on Quantum Mechanics. So he studied constrained dynamical systems. And if you read the opening chapter, it's an absolutely beautiful book, which is still the sort of guide to quantization in all systems, from gravity to string theory to wherever, in the opening of that book, he clearly says the Hamiltonian formalism is, he implies it is superior to the Lagrangian formalism. And there's this funny contradiction, because the Lagrangian formalism is, of course, so nice because it incorporates all the symmetries in physics so nicely. you can write the Lagrangian for the standard model. And it's really beautiful, and it's obvious. It's Lorentz invariant, gauge invariant. It's all the symmetries are most apparent in the Lagrangian formulas. And when you write the Hamiltonian formulas, you have to pick a time slicing, and that's arbitrary. And so everything becomes ugly. Nevertheless, the dynamics are well-defined in the Hamiltonian formalism. And in the simple case, you see that the Lagrangian formalism doesn't really exist. So this is a funny point which people seem to gloss over. Maybe they've forgotten. Okay, so here is our action. That the action is proportional to the length of the world line, if I have the units right, which I probably don't. There's a C somewhere. Is it C? Yeah, probably that's right. Because this includes a C dt. This would have dimensions of C dt. And then I get my kinetic energy times T as the units. So that's my action in flat Minkowski space-time. Now let's consider coupling this particle to electromagnetism. How's it going to couple? Well, basically the only thing I have for my particle is dx mu. I mean, that's what defines the particle, is the element of its world line. How on earth am I going to couple that to F mu nu, the field strength? I want to write down some term in the action, plus electric charge, dx mu, has to couple some way to F mu nu, but F mu nu has two indices. So what should I couple it to? It's only one option. In relativity, it's usually true. There's really only one option. That's why it's such a beautiful theory. Do you remember the definition of... remember we had one of these equations, this thing equals zero, implied that F mu nu, at least locally, could be written as d mu a nu minus d mu a mu, where a is the vector potential. Okay? So that's the only thing you have around. And that's the action for a relativistic particle coupled to electromagnetism. Yeah?
Couldn't you have higher order terms like dx mu, f mu nu, a mu, both f and a, for example?
You could. Let me just think about that. Well, neither is this. This is not gauge invariant either. And it's very important it's not gauge invariant, by the way, because this is how you detect magnetic flux by going around it. This is precisely the Aronoff-Bohm phase, right? That if I compute the action for a particle where I just move the particle around a magnetic flux tube, even though F mu nu is zero, A mu cannot be zero. A mu is pure gauge, but its integral is not zero because you have integral A dot dl equals integral B dot ds, right? If I have a little flux tube of containing magnetic field, then when I go around a contour enclosing that flux tube, it measures the total flux through the tube. So the action changes. That is the Aronoff-Bohm phase, and that is how you can detect quantum interference between particles traveling on either side of a flux tube. This term, yeah, I don't have an obvious argument against this. What I would say is that the dimensions are a bit, the dimensions are such. You see, F, what are the dimensions of F? We did this before. F is dimensions 1 of a length squared, right? Because Coulomb law, electric field goes like 1 over. So F goes like 1 over length squared. So you better have some length squared here to make the dimensions right. Now, a length is 1 over a mass in natural units. And so Such terms you would expect to be suppressed by inverse powers of the mass. And if the mass scale is large, they will be small. Yeah, it's only a rough argument, but that's the kind of argument people use in order to ignore such terms and higher derivative terms. There may be a better argument. I don't know. Okay, so this is really the only thing you can write down. And the definition of electric charge is the coefficient of this term in the action. Okay, it's a number. It's dimensionless. At least in length units, it's dimensionless. Let's see if these units make any sense. A mu should have dimensions 1 over length. This is a length, so at least the action has no length dimensions. And yeah, I think that is correct. But to verify this, let us go ahead and vary it, and we'll get the equation of motion. Okay, for the particle. And if we're lucky, this might turn out to be the Lorentz force equation. Of course, I know we are lucky. So now, before we do that, so this term is going to give the Lorentz force. Okay. So I hope you're getting the impression that even though relativity and is a huge, complicated subject, once the principles are clear, you can actually forget about everything. And everything is more or less forced on you by those principles, including things like the Lorentz force and those horrible transformation laws of magnetic fields and all these other things. They're just forced on you. Okay, let's vary it. Oh, actually, before we do that, because it's painful, I said we're going to couple it to electromagnetism and gravity. Now, how are we going to include gravity? Well, the very obvious way here, and you know this in general relativity, is we're going to change the space-time metric, eta, the thing you use to measure distances in Minkowski space. This is just going to go over into g, which is a function of x. And that will describe gravity. That describes the influence of gravity on the particle. And there's really nothing else you could do that would introduce the force of gravity on the particle within relativity. So let's vary the action. And so what I get is m naught c. Now I've got to vary the square root. This is a bit of a pain, but I get eta mu nu dx mu d delta x mu. So the idea is that x mu goes to x mu plus delta x mu. And let me just introduce some parameter here. It doesn't really matter what this parameter is. But let me just pick proper time as just to be definite. So this action is an integral over proper time. And then what I have is dx mu d tor, d delta x mu d tor over the, let me leave it general. Doesn't really leave it completely general. And you'll see the answer is independent of whatever that parameter is. So when we vary it, I've got to vary this guy, the argument to the square root, and then divide by the square root. Minus eta mu nu dx mu d lambda dx nu d lambda d lambda.
I'm a bit confused about the coefficient. You wrote down m0 c square in the top, and now you use the
root m0. Yeah, it's just because I had a c squared somewhere. Oh, I forgot. I forgot this. No, I had a constant. Good point.
Yeah, you had a constant for the case where you took out.
You're
the same constant, actually. One of them is.
Oh, sorry. So this should be.
This is correct.
That one is wrong.
No, that one is also correct. It's just they are not the same constant. Because if you go to the right above, you took one C out.
Oh, true. Yeah, but okay. I believe this is correct anyway. I think this is correct because this includes CBT, right? And the dimensions of the action should be half mv squared dt. So I think this one is correct. I can go back later and check that. Okay, so I vary this guy and divide by the square root. Now what you notice is that the square root here just converts the d lambda into a d tor, right? Because d tor is equal to square root minus e to mu nu dx mu d lambda dx nu d lambda times d lambda. So the presence of this square root just converts one of these d lambdas into a d tor. And then this has one in the numerator, one in the denominator, so I can change both of those to d tor. So basically, this term is just m naught c integral e to mu nu d tor dx mu d tor d delta x mu d tor. So you see the variation can be written this way no matter what the parameterization was you picked. And now let's vary the other term. Okay, so here I have Q integral. Now let's first vary the, I'm going to write this as dx mu d tor. And first vary a mu, I get a mu comma nu delta x nu. So a mu is a function of x. Okay. Times dx mu d tor. Times d tor. And now I'm going to vary the x. Let's put the d tor over here. Plus a mu d delta x mu d tor right. And so now what I have to do is integrate by parts. And this becomes a mu. Now d by d tor of a mu will be a mu comma nu dx nu d tor times delta x mu. Right? So a mu is a function of x of tor. So when I differentiate with respect to tor, I've got to differentiate with respect to each one of the x's and multiply by dx d tor. Okay, so what I end up with is delta s is equal to integrating the first terms by parts. I get integral minus d2x mu d tor squared delta x mu e to mu nu. And then in the second term, I get plus q d nu a mu minus d mu a nu times dx mu d tor. No mass there. And so what you end up with equals zero. This implies that m naught d 2 x mu d tor squared equals q d x mu d tor f nu mu. Sorry, there's a d x mu. Flip the indices. Okay, and this we shall see next time is nothing but the Lorentz force. Any questions? Yeah.
Is there a delta x nu missing in the second term?
Yes, probably there is. Yes, you're right. So this is contracted, and then there's a delta x mu. Yeah, that's right.
What does it mean when you write a mu comma nu?
Oh, thanks for asking. Sometimes I write this as a nu comma mu. So comma mu. So we often write d by dx mu of a alpha, let's say. We can write it as del mu of a alpha, or we can write that as a alpha comma mu. So the comma just indicates a derivative. When you have all these indices in relativity, you have to find ways to shortcut to the answer. Okay, so next time we will, in fact, you can do it very easily yourselves. You can almost do it by eye. If I set nu equals to I, a spatial coordinate, this is I. There are going to be two terms with the 0, 0 and the, let's say, JJ. The 0, 0 terms are going to give me the electric field, EI, because that's FI 0. The Fij dx j dt, well, Fij is epsilon b. And you immediately see you get the Lorentz force law, qe plus v cross b. So next time we're going to consider the action for electromagnetism coupled to the particle. And then I believe on Friday afternoon, is that right? You're going to check that the total energy and momentum is conserved for the coupled system of electromagnetism plus the particle. Any other questions? I forgot to take a break. Can you yell at me tomorrow? Halfway through. Shut up! Any other comments or questions? Yeah.
No? So at some point, we had this. So okay, I went back to this paper that Einstein actually wrote a bit like that. Radiation would transfer inertia, I think.
Radiation, well?
Between absorbing and emitting would transfer inertia. Can you see this if you do this with the AMU, FAMU stuff?
Right, so it's interesting. Einstein's paper on E equals mc squared, the title of it is, does radiation affect the inertia of a particle? It's words to that effect. So he definitely has radiation and inertia. Inertia is nothing but mass, rest mass. And the argument we went through shows that when the particle emits radiation, its mass must change. And because its energy is mc squared, and the energy goes down as it emits the radiation. So the conclusion of his paper is that indeed radiation carries away inertia. Now, if you mean by inertia rest mass, the radiation itself doesn't have any inertia. There's no rest mass for radiation. But if a particle with inertia emits radiation, its own inertia changes. Okay? But you know, inertia is not really a very fundamental thing. Particles can emit energy. Fundamental things are energy and momentum. And they are fundamental because the universe is, the world we live in is independent of time, almost, and translation invariant. That's why energy and momentum exist, and those are really the fundamental entities. So again, the beauty of relativity is you really focus on what's fundamental, and you can forget about everything else. At least that's the idea. Physics is much simpler when you use relativity. Yeah.
We heard that the electromagnetic potential, the AMU, exists only locally.
Correct.
In general. Is there some way?
Well, it exists locally under very, very general conditions. Okay. Meaning, if space is Minkowski, there's no problem. If space is Minkowski and there are no magnetic monopoles, the electromagnetic potential exists everywhere without any difficulty. If space gets curved, the way in which you would run into difficulties is if the topology of space becomes weird.
Yeah.
So if there's a wormhole that suddenly appears in this room and if some magnetic flux is coming out of the wormhole, then I would have difficulty writing down electromagnetic potential. Now, nothing like that has ever been seen, so I'm not sure we should worry about it too much.
So a black hole is not a problem?
A black hole is not a problem unless it carries magnetic charge. Okay, so black holes, in principle, can carry magnetic charge. Nobody's ever seen one carrying magnetic charge, but in principle, they could do that. And if they have magnetic charge, in order to describe the vector potential around a black hole, you could not, or the AMU around this magnetic black hole, you would have to use two coordinate patches. And in one patch, you'd have one vector potential, and the other patch, you'd have another vector potential. And they would differ by a gauge transformation on the overlap region. So it's possible to do, but there's no compelling reason so far. I mean, we kind of hope for such complications to exist in nature, but unfortunately haven't discovered any. It's a search for magnetic monopoles has been going on for 50 years, since Dirac really realized that, you see, so what Dirac showed is that the existence of even one monopole anywhere in the universe requires that electric charge is quantized. It's just a theoretical consistency condition. And so for that reason, people want to find the monopole. But it doesn't matter where it is. Okay, it may be beyond view. So people have searched and searched and searched for monopoles all kinds of ways, using neutron stars to capture them, or people have built laboratory equipment. And when I was a PhD student, there was a signal. Somebody found it. Blasco Barrera in Stanford found a magnetic monopole. Everybody got really excited. And my advisor was David Olive, who was the founder of superstring theory and also proposed electromagnetic duality in supersymmetric gauge theories. And so he was tremendously excited. But they built a much bigger apparatus, and they searched for 1,000 times more with more sensitivity, and they never found another one. So maybe that was the one. But so the monopole search has been going on and on. And of course, string theory does predict monopoles. I mean, as a general feature, would have monopoles. Grand unified theories predict magnetic monopoles. None of them have been observed. And then you get into all kinds of complications, because now you have all these theories that predict something not observed, so you have to invent mechanisms to get rid of the things you predicted which aren't seen. So that's why inflation was invented, actually, was to get rid of the monopoles. So my point of view has always been it's not exactly compelling. If you write down a theory, and the theory gives a prediction, you find it's wrong, say, I must add something else to sweep away that wrong prediction. Well, that's how inflation was invented. So I've always been a little bit skeptical of adding bells and whistles, and you know, then you add inflation, then you discover, whoops, I've got a multiverse, or I've got some catastrophe. Now I have to invent something else that's going to fix that catastrophe. Yeah, I think you're on a slippery slope to oblivion. But or chaos, yeah. I know, but they keep asking me questions. All right, I'll see you tomorrow.